Passion for the science of life drives today's guest, Dr. Dayan Goodenow, to look beyond disease, or rather, before disease. Our biochemistry has a story to tell, and he reads it very well. His book is titled Breaking Alzheimer's, and it tells a very promising story. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Dayan, before we start talking about your medical research and insights written into your book, Breaking Alzheimer's, I'd love to hear you define biochemical health.
Sure. People have this aversion to biochemistry. They think it's so complicated, and that's just really not true. Our biology follows mostly the same logic of anything else in our life. Biochemical health is really just the human body. My background is in chemistry and in psychiatric medicine, but I really see the world in three levels. One is the biology of the world, which is how people interact, organisms interact with each other. And then there's a really the deep philosophical stuff, which is physics, which is the nature of reality. And then biochemistry. So biochemistry is just the chemistry of living things, whereas chemistry is your car, automobile, burning fuel. Chemistry is the chemical atoms and molecules that make us who we are. And these things get transformed. And what comes in must come out. And our body is dynamic and alive in that regard. And there's actually relatively few simple principles that are part of human biology. So biochemistry is really about understanding how the body works and then to create reserve capacity. Like you want to have a savings account of good things in your biochemistry, and you want to make sure you don't have excess bad things, and you want to make sure you're not missing critical elements that you need. And then the human body has, like I said, very simple principles. Really, the human body is a hybrid electric car. We eat harder carbons, right? The sun beats down and plants convert carbon dioxide and water into sugar. And then we ultimately take some form of that sugar, gets converted by other animals and so on. And when we consume hydrocarbons, which is either, like I said, carbohydrates or fats or proteins in your meals, we burn that. We burn it into carbon dioxide and water, just the same way that your car engine does. And we use that energy that gets released from burning hydrocarbons to essentially charge a battery. And that battery is our mitochondria. And we run on battery energy is what the body runs on. And there's basic principles that keep it operating. And then the other part of the human body that is important is the membranes of our body. Like we're not a bowl of soup, I tell people. Like you have structure, like you have all the cells of your body. And what separates your heart cell from your lung cell and the internal components of a cell is biological lipid membranes. It's kind of like your house and the walls of your house. So same way you separate your kitchen from your bathroom from your bedroom with the walls, material go in and out, your systems work the same way. And so we have a lipid membrane matrix. Like that's kind of the operating structure. And if that's not tuned properly, it's kind of the difference between walking outside on hard surface versus walking in the mud. And then obviously everything about you changes when you walk in a different environment. So there's certain basic things that we want to make sure are maintained. And if you maintain those things, your health will follow.
Tell us about how your biochemical sleuthing led you into discovering what we're now calling plasmalogens.
So plasmalogens are one of those lipid membrane molecules. They're part of all the cells of your body. But yeah, so one of the things understanding how your biochemistry is working is being able to measure your biochemistry. And so back in the 1990s, when the genomics revolution was really taking off and we were sequencing the genomes of organisms and we were trying to understand all that genetic information, what was missing from that equation was all the small molecules that aren't part of your genome. You know, when you eat an orange, the fruit and the sugar that's in an orange is the same in you as it is in a plant, as it is in, you know, your dog or your cat. So the biochemistry really is the same across all these species, even though the genetics are different. And so we need to actually measure all of those small molecules. And I invented a technology that allowed me to measure thousands and thousands of small molecules simultaneously. This technology allowed me to then compare what happens when someone has an illness. What is biochemically different with someone with colon cancer versus someone who does not have colon cancer? What is biochemically different between someone who has Alzheimer's versus someone who does not have Alzheimer's? Because, like you said, we are biochemical entities. That's our existence. And so if you and I can visually see a difference between one person and another in terms of a health situation, there is always going to be a biochemical signature of that because that's who we are. And so I invented a technology that could actually do that. And my original thinking at that time was that was going to be useful for diagnosing people with a disease versus people who don't have a disease. And that is actually true. But what became more important than being able to say, here's a person with a disease biochemically, here's a person without it, was that these biochemical changes were not occurring as a result of the disease. So the disease wasn't causing a change in the biochemistry. What was happening is that the biochemistry was changing first, and then the person was getting a disease. And so it was more and more research studies and thousands of persons, this became more and more clear. And so your biochemistry is really like a ball tire, right? It sets you up for having a flat. It's not that flat tires cause ball tires. It's ball tires cause flat tires.
Right.
Right. And that's kind of where the story goes. And then, and like every human disease that we have, it's always an interplay between your susceptibility of the disease versus the disease trigger itself.
Yes. And right? Let me interrupt one second here, Dayan.
Sure.
I think if we all got on the same page about defining disease, which is where you're going right now, I believe, but
yes,
it seems like it's become about pinpointing symptoms. And from where you're working, I see it as we don't need to do naming, really. We just need to stay more in touch with what these precursor type things that are going on beneath the surface are doing.
That's exactly right. What we traditionally call disease is actually symptoms of disease. Okay, so Alzheimer's is not a disease. Alzheimer's is a symptom of impaired biochemistry. And specifically for the Alzheimer's, it's impaired cholinergic neuron activity. Like the membranes don't release the neurotransmitter appropriately, acetylcholine, which is the signal that we use for cognition in the brain. And when that signal is decreased, then the neurons will shrink, we get pathology, and so we get Alzheimer's. And so then we call Alzheimer's a disease, but really fundamentally it's a symptom of disease. Same thing with cancer. Cancer is a symptom of cells being unable to get into the regular fasting state. And so that creates a situation where you get a disease process that occurs. So you're absolutely 100% correct. So we keep on chasing symptoms. And if we continue to chase just symptoms of disease, all we end up doing is living longer with disease, okay? We have a longer, unhealthy life. It's logically backwards, where this work kind of came organically over time. And one of the most eye-opening experiences was a project we were doing in colon cancer in Osaka, Japan. And we looked at people before and after colon cancer, and then we had people after their surgical removal, and they're technically cured of colon cancer. And we found that the biomarkers that we were measuring that were predicting and diagnosing colon cancer didn't change after we removed the tumor, clearly indicating that the tumor wasn't causing the biochemistry. And so we said, we didn't really believe it. So we did an entire second study in another city of Japan called Chiba, and we got exactly the same results, indicating that it's this biochemical change that occurs first and sets up your susceptibility. And so, and it becomes that bald tire scenario. And so just because you have a bald tire doesn't mean you will get a disease, but the probability will be that you will. So it means all you need is a small, sharp stone to cause a flat. If you have brand new tires, doesn't mean you're guaranteed of never getting a disease, but you now need to run over a pretty strong nail to get the disease. So the disease-causing trigger has to be so much stronger depending upon your susceptibility.
Yes.
And then you can fix these things. That's the best thing, is it? And so you use diseases as education. What diseases do is that they tell us what biochemical systems are likely or commonly become abnormal or dysfunctional. And so we now can look for those in advance and fix them before disease. We live in a world where you drive your car, biochemically that is, or medically, basically you drive a car without any oil till it fails. And then once it fails, you go in and fix the oil. It's completely backwards to how anyone would run their regular life. So that's kind of what we do. We're basically take all the diseases that we know. Every single disease that humans are afflicted with has a biochemical prodrome. And a prodrome is that biochemistry change that occurs before the disease comes. And so since we know that already, we can go in advance and create biochemical reserve capacity. So plasmalogens are one of those things. Low levels of plasmalogens ultimately cause not just Alzheimer's, but other neurological diseases as well. Since we know that in advance, it's just not worth the risk of having low plasmalogens. So we can now supplement those molecules and make sure that you have sufficient levels at all times, regardless of whether you have a disease at this point in time or not.
Yes, prevention is the much better place to start, of course.
Exactly. And so that's kind of where the plasmalogen story came in. So we did projects with Alzheimer's disease. My technology identified these plasmalogens that were decreased. And then as a scientist, you start asking the question, okay, is this a symptom or is it a cause? And how you typically determine that is, as you do more and more research, if you find some other reason for the change other than the disease, then you can say, oh, this is causing the plasmalogen depletion first. So, for example, if you say, oh, only people who have a bacterial infection have low plasmalogens, then you can say, okay, the low plasmalogens are being caused by a bacterial infection, so to speak. But when we did that over and over again, even up to the actual brain structure, plasmalogens are the most proximate or the closest to what we observe in reduced cognition. And so then the question is, how do we fix those things? And then since I'm a synthetic chemist, we were able to design molecules, build them, and they're precursors. So they survive your stomach, and then they get absorbed, and they restore your blood levels and tissue levels of plasmalogens. So now we can do that. And it's pretty exciting because we've known about plasmalogens for about 100 years. This is the other thing about chemistry. It's like a lost science, even though we've had 100 years of really good biochemical work all through the 50s and 60s and 70s. And then when the genomics came along, the traditional biochemistry was kind of put on the back burner a little bit. So it's not that we don't know a lot about biochemistry. We actually know a lot about biochemistry, and we've known a lot about it for many, many years. It's kind of been put off to the side. And so this molecule plasmalogens, like I wasn't the first person to discover the existence of plasmalogens. We've known about them for 100 years. And we've known how important they are because children who are born with genetic mutations that impair their ability to make plasmalogens, they're born with dwarfism, they're born with severe neurological disease. Most of them will not live to the age of 10. Okay, most of them die within the first few years of their life. So we know absolutely that plasmalogens are critical to human life as it appears early in life. Then we've also known that there has been decreases late in life. There's been studies of plasmalogens decreasing. But putting those pieces together again, where my contribution comes in, is I've done all that research. I'm the one that really recognized that the blood levels are actually correlated with your brain levels, and that starting in their 50s and 60s, they start decreasing. And when you don't have enough to maintain your levels, the reserve that you had when you were young starts to get depleted. And that rate of depletion is a little bit different in everybody. And so it's basically having a pail of water with a little hole in it, and it's just kind of dripping out on you. And the plasmalogens are like that. And what makes them so weird, it's almost like if you had to create some sort of planned obsolescence where, okay, I'm going to make a washing machine and I'm going to intentionally put a weak belt in it so that it will only last 20 years. That would be what a plasmalogen is. Because we're dealing with a molecule that isn't rare. Okay, 20 to 30% of all the lipids of your body are plasmalogens. So we're not talking about small amounts. We're talking grams. The protective coating of your neuron sheath, it's like the plastic coating on a copper wire type of thing that keeps your neurons safe and allows the electrical impulse to go long distances. That's huge concentrations of plasmalogens in there. And you have to make them yourself. We can't get them from our diet. So all the other nutritional building blocks of the human body, that's all dietarily obtained. But plasmalogens, your body must physically make them, because the last step that is in their manufacture creates this kind of special bond. It's called a vinyl ether bond, but it makes it very sensitive to acid and peroxides. And those are things that naturally occur in your body, but under different times of stress, but your body has ways to neutralize them. They're natural. Plasmalogens are one of those molecules that neutralize these acids, as well as being involved in, you know, neurotransmitter release and things. And so what happens then is if you eat an animal product, right? Because if you have lots of plasmalogens, animal products have lots of plasmalogens. So why can't I just eat animal products and get all the plasmalogens I need? Well, that bond is very sensitive to acid. So as soon as it hits your stomach acids in your digestive tract, it blows up. So you can't absorb it. So now you're stuck with a critical molecule that has its own independent manufacturing process. Okay. It's, they call it a single non-redundant system. Like it's just like, it's a one-way street and you must make them all yourself. And so if your consumption of them, so oxidative stress, or you're consuming a lot of them, or your ability to make them declines, at some point your manufacturing capacity becomes less than your daily usage needs. And when that delta becomes in the negative, it's basically like having a savings account and you're spending more money every month than you're making. And it's just a matter of time now before you go broke.
Right. Now, the way you were describing them a couple of minutes ago with the sheathing, it sounds like it would be a component of MS as well. Is that true or not?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Multiple sclerosis and autism, ALS.
Right. Can you perhaps share some specifics about a particular research study, or if someone starts on the plasmalogens who has Alzheimer's, are you seeing reversals? Is it necessary to continue with plasmalogens the rest of your life as a supplement, or will it help work? Like you mentioned earlier, is it a true precursor in that it'll start stimulating the body's own production?
A little bit of both, but clearly it's one that you ultimately will end up having long-term supplementation. And the power of the plasmalogens are such that it's not worth the risk of having low levels. It's kind of like the vitamin D story, okay? So most people understand vitamin D. If you get sunlight, your skin can make vitamin D. But it's very hard to maintain healthy levels of vitamin D. Theoretically, it's possible. If I dedicate myself to spending a certain amount of time in the sunlight at a certain latitude of the earth, that UV radiation will allow my body to make all the vitamin D I want. So if I'm a construction worker, I have lots of vitamin D in my body. But most of us that work indoors and do things, it's very, very difficult to get sufficient vitamin D levels. Plasmalogens are the same way. So exercise, proper fasting, those things all contribute to improve plasmalogen levels or improve ability for your body to make your plasmalogen levels. But even as we get older, we get accumulation of things that have happened to us. We get a little bit of liver dysfunction. We get, Tylenol, and there's a thousand different stressors that can accumulate over our life. So it is very difficult to maintain biochemical reserve capacity of plasmalogens without supplementation. So that's one. Typically speaking, most people are looking at long-term supplementation. I certainly am personally. My dad, my family are all on long-term supplements on it.
Could you give us an example of either a group of people or a personal story that you know of through your
Absolutely.
Research?
Yeah, so I am kind of talking in generalities. And so let me kind of get to the meat of the matter. So we just finished releasing clinical trial results last week at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Denver. We did our Prodrome Neuro is a plasmalogen supplement. It's a precursor. It contains 100% omega-3, which is the DHA. People think about it for fish oil, but your body makes its own DHA. And that DHA is what provides membrane fluidity and the ability for your neurons to release their neurotransmitters. Since you're biochemical, the switch that turns your neurons on and off is like the light switch of your house. So you have a wire, okay, that protective sheath that goes from, say, your kitchen to your bedroom. That wire has a coating on it, and there's a copper wire in between. So your white matter, so multiple sclerosis and autism-like diseases, or ALS, it is the protective sheath around that copper wire that degrades so that the electrical signal from your bedroom to your kitchen gets disrupted in your wall, okay, that protective plastic coating of your wire gets degraded, like a mouse is chewing on it. And so the signal gets disrupted in the pathway. And that's a white matter disease. And that happens with, say, stroke, multiple sclerosis, autism type diseases. So that's where the neuron signal gets impaired sitting in your wall. The second part of whether or not you can turn your lights on and off is actually at the switch, where you actually physically connect two wires together. So they're disconnected until you flip the switch. That part where the switch is being flipped on and off is called your neuron synapse. And that's how one neuron connects to another, basically. And you just do that switching extremely fast. And you do many, many, many of them. Your brain is incredible. The computing power of the human brain is really almost unfathomable in size. But that, again, you're not made of copper wire, right? We're made of actually biochemistry. And we're made of lipids. We're made of these things. So plasmalogens are the molecules that are in that synaptic connection. They're there on the one neuron to the next. So there's a little gap between the two neurons called the synapse. And then how that synapse gets connected together when you turn your switch on and off is biochemicals are released from one neuron into the synaptic cleft, and then they react with the next neuron. And that's what turns the light on of the next neuron, basically. And the biochemistry that allows those neurotransmitters to be released requires plasmalogens. And so if you don't have enough plasmalogens, then the neurotransmitters don't get released into the synaptic cleft, and then you don't get a signal.
And does it also work into the wall, into that scenario, once it goes through the switch?
So on both of them. Yeah. So the second product that we have is called prodrome glia, and that has omega-9 in it. So glia is the scientific name for your white matter tracts.
Right.
So when you get a stroke, it's your white matter. And when you get a concussion, it's white matter. And so that's more of a protective perspective. And that contains omega-9 plasmalogens, the kind of fatty acids that you get from olive oil, for example. And those are the ones that create a really tight, impermeable protection. So yes, so in MS and autism, we use plasmalogen that goes directly into the white matter of the body. And so that's what we presented last week at the Alzheimer's conference, was in persons diagnosed with cognitive impairment. So these were already confirmed to have mental issues. And we took 22 people. It was a small investigational work, even though we have thousands and thousands of people on our product right now. And I have personal anecdotal stuff I can share with you. But this controlled trial, we wanted to make sure we had the right dosage. So the prodrome neuro comes in a bottle. It's like 30 milliliters. And typically, most people take, for prevention, it's 1 mil per day. So one bottle will last you 1 month. The 22 people went on one bottle a month for 1 month. Then we doubled the dose, and then they went for one bottle would last every 2 weeks for 2 months. And the last month, they took one bottle every week, and that would be for the last month. So they got four times the dose. And then they had a one-month washout period. We took blood samples before every month and at the end of every month. We measured their cognition using cognitive testing at the end of every month. And we also measured their mobility. And we measured mobility with a simple test called a sit-stand. It's basically you take a stopwatch and you ask someone to say, can you sit and stand as many times as you can in a 30-second period? And most people can do somewhere in the 10 to 30 range, right? And we would measure to see if their muscularity or their strength changed over the course of this four-month trial. Now, remember, Alzheimer's is a disease classically considered a progressive degenerative disease. You don't get better. The pharmaceutical process is, can I prevent or can I slow down the decline? No one's really talking about recovery from Alzheimer's. But in this trial, we had four people that had moderate, so they were very obviously clinically impaired. Three of those four people actually improved an entire score level in only 4 months. And so we had a statistically significant cognitive improvement, even though we had such a small study. And so to get statistical improvement in a small number is really, really difficult, because that's why science, and that's why companies run really big trials, because you want, the more people you have, the more likely you are going to show a statistical effect. We showed that in only 22 people. And then in mobility, 55% improved by more than two sit stands in an only 4 month period, and over 80% stayed stable.
They must be elated.
Yes, it was really exciting. So this is actually the first time. So like, as I mentioned, it's hard to really fathom it because I've been working on this thing for 15 more years now. We've known about plasmalogens for 100 years. This was the first time in human history that we have shown that we can target plasmalogens and elevate plasmalogens in the human body. That's just a remarkable thing to think about. We've known about it for 100 years. We know that if you're born with plasmalogen defects, you die. I have thousands and thousands of clinical trial data sets, multiple papers from independent research from around the world showing decreased plasmalogens are associated with increased mortality, associated with an increased risk of dementia. It's biochemically the mechanism through which it acts. So it's not just where there's smoke, there's fire. There's an actual mechanism of how it works. And this has all been done, but yet we haven't been able to do that. And so the plasmalogen precursors, protom neuron, protom glia, are exciting because they do two things. They restore your overall plasmalogen levels, but they're a precursor, which means they actually go into every single cell of your body and allows every single cell of your body to make their own plasmalogens on demand. And when you take the supplement every day, you get a pulse of that. It's food for all of these cells, these plasmalogens, and your overall circulating levels increase. And we showed that we had a dose-dependent increase. So as we increase the amount of plasmalogens that you take, your plasmalogen levels increase in your blood. What was also really important was that even though the blood plasmalogen level for large clinical trials have all shown that low levels are predictive of your future decline. But in this trial, people who already have clinical symptoms, there was no difference in people's improvement in the disease based upon their blood plasmalogen levels. So there was 9 people who had a very clear a complete unit improvement in their cognitive status. 5 of those people were in the low plasmalogen at baseline level, and 4 of those were in high plasmalogens at baseline. So it indicates that when we're actually treating it, your pre-existing level doesn't determine whether you will get a benefit from the plasmalogen or not, which is important because remember, you're measuring blood levels. It's very powerful for a predictor. Proteome scan is a blood test that we use. It really understands your overall biochemical health. And it's simple, easy to understand. It's like a snapshot of saying, okay, I want to make sure there's no boogeyman under the bed that I have no idea. Okay, nothing's worse than having some strange biochemical defect that you don't know about that you can fix instantly. Phosphatidylcholine, for example, like good old-fashioned lethicin, is a major problem. People get deficient in this molecule. They might be a strict vegetarian or for whatever reason, and choline deficiencies are people, we don't measure them, and it's easy to fix. So there's lots of nutritional deficiencies that are so easy to fix, but no one really looks for them, and they have lots of different consequences. And so people will end up with problems and they won't know where it came from. And sometimes a very simple biochemical defect is causing it. And it's a very simple fix and it's a very inexpensive fix.
Next week, we'll conclude our interview with Dr. Dan Goodenow, the author of Breaking Alzheimer's. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are on the usual platforms, and if not, let us know. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.